Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Lisa Dell, and I'm excited to dedicate today's show to the music of Saad Haddad, whose compositions have been praised for their remarkable fusion of Western music and Middle Eastern musical traditions. I'm excited to get his perspective on the music he's written. Saad's work has been performed by Jack Quartet, International Contemporary Ensemble, Imani Winds, Minnesota Orchestra, LA Phil, American Composers Orchestra, Albany Symphony, and many others. He's received many awards for his compositions, including the Jerome Fund for New Music Grant, the Palmer Dixon Award from the Juilliard School, the Aaron Copland Residency Award, and the Barlow Endowment General Commission. He's also received the Charles Ives Fellowship from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's currently a Dean's Fellow at Columbia University, where he served as Young Concert Artist Composer in Residence from 2019 to 2021. And he's also the Young American Composer in Residence for the California Symphony through 2026. Saad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We opened the show with your Hasal Sul 1, which means sequence in Arabic. And what we heard was recorded by Brandon Patrick George of Imani Winds. And it can be heard on his new solo album, which was released in September 2023. And I saw the piece also won an award at the 2022 Mid-Atlantic Flute Convention. Can you tell us just a bit more about the piece? And, you know, did Brandon approach you to write this for an album concept, or did that come later?
So what happened with this? I have to back up even further from Brandon. And Brandon is a terrific flute player. And it was kind of by accident that I met him, actually. So what happened was, I've been wanting to do these big, huge set of solo pieces. I normally write these big orchestra pieces. And oftentimes as a composer, it's hard to experiment when you're dealing with an orchestra because you have so little time to rehearse, and which is completely understandable. But with solo repertoire, the player can just be practicing on their own till kingdom come. You know, they don't have to rely on anybody else. So when COVID started, I pretty much reverted to writing solo pieces. So I wrote a piece for solo viola. I wrote a piece for, I just finished a piece actually for solo harp, et cetera. I have one for solo trumpet, solo oboe actually. So, I have one for solo flute, and the flute one was actually the very first one I decided to write. And I wrote it for a flute player in upstate New York named Dustin White. And he was the one actually that, I started writing the piece for in the beginning, and he's interested in a lot of the stuff I'm interested in, traditional Arabic music and so on. And, together we worked on the piece a lot. And with this particular piece, I had the idea of basing it off of a really old, piece by Bach, not J.S. Bach, but his son, C.P.E. Bach. And I basically wrote the piece based off of that. And it wasn't until several months later that actually Brandon Patrick George, he saw it on my site, on my website, and he purchased it just out of nowhere. And he actually wrote me saying, "Hey, you know, I want to play this piece. Has it been recorded? Is what? Can you tell me more about it?" Because he liked that C.P.E. Bach connection. He really liked that I based it off of a piece by him, which is played a ton in the flute world, the sonata in A minor. So that's how we started collaborating, me and Brandon. And now it's really Brandon's piece in a way, because he recorded it for the first time on his album Twofold. And I mean, he'll be playing it around once he's, as he's going around playing his album, of course, around the country and so on. So that's how me and Brandon got hooked up. It was kind of randomly.
Has that happened before, where someone's like on your site and you kind of follow along, like they found your music, they purchased it? Cause that seems like, you know, something you just kind of happened upon, but is that a normal occurrence for you?
It happens pretty regularly. I mean, because I have a site that is pretty, I mean, it's kind of, to be honest with you, if you go on my site, it looks like from the early 2000s or something. I mean, it's very basic, but actually it's really easy too, to kind of navigate around. Everything is there. The scores are there. I make it super clear how to buy the stuff. I have program, everything that you can possibly want is there on my site. You don't have to go anywhere else. So In a way, I'm sure that when he was searching, I think what he was doing was searching for music that had to do with C.P. Bach in some way. And I think that's how he found the music, actually. I think just Google searching, because how else would he have found it? Because he wanted that, he liked that piece.
Yeah.
So I think there was some connection. Because he didn't know who he didn't know who I was before.
Yeah.
But it's happened actually a number of times where I've never met the performer, and they request the music. Maybe they've heard it somewhere else, or they had a musician tell them about it that I didn't know, but it happens. I mean, the further along one goes doing this, they're not just in a vacuum. So I would hope.
Yeah.
It's interesting because when, you know, you look at your bio and just all the works that you have on your website, you can see that you're often exploring, you know, Middle Eastern and Western music and how to integrate those. So it's interesting that Brandon found you through Bach. When one just reads about, you know, who is Saad Haddad, they see how you're using your Middle Eastern background to really bring into your music. So that's why I found it so interesting that he found you, you know, in that way. But, you know, just thinking about your compositional approach and really tying in who you are to your music. Can you tell us just how you influenced your career in that way? Like, was that a decision as soon as you became a composer that you were going to do that?
No. I mean, so I didn't find out until later in college. I went to USC in Los Angeles that people didn't know they wanted to be composers until much later. It's not like a violinist or a pianist or something like that, where they are learning when they're like four and they kind of have an idea that they're going to do this for the rest of their life. Composing doesn't work that way. Usually they find out when they're much older, 17, 18, sometimes even older than that. And I was the weirdo, I felt like, that knew when he was seven that he wanted to compose. And I definitely was one of the weirdos growing up saying that I was going to write a symphony one day. I mean, that was my goal, you know? And I mean, if you count writing orchestral music as a symphony, I suppose, I mean, at that time, that's probably what I thought in my brain. I mean, I've done over a dozen of those by now. So the 7-year-old version of me probably will look at me and be like, wow, you actually did what you said you were going to do. So to me, everything I do now because of that is kind of like, it's kind of like extra, if that makes sense. Like I don't sit around thinking, oh my God, I wish I were to do this dream project of mine like one day. I don't sit like that. I'm like very thankful actually from where I am right now, to be honest with you. But going back to where I was when I was 7, I picked up a book about Mozart. I was in like second grade at that time, and they had all these, we did these months where it's a science month, then the literature month, the music month, and we had to do these like 1-page biographies on various famous people. I remember doing Steinbeck for literature. I remember doing Einstein for science. And when it came to the music month, I found the Mozart book. And in the Mozart book, it said that when he was 5 years old, he wrote his first piece of music. And my first thought when I read that line was, I'm already 7 years old. And everything just like bounced from there, you know. And looking back on it, it's especially with today's culture, it's probably an unhealthy thought, but at least that's the spark. That was my spark in terms of wanting to be a composer. That was it. And from there, yeah. I learned the piano just to compose. That was the reason I wanted to learn the notes, read the notes, write the notes. And it's been that way since, like it hasn't changed.
Wow. So when did you start bringing you like into composing and, you know, being of Middle Eastern descent?
That stuff happened way later. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was doing the Mozart, the Brahms, everybody else. Cause I grew up here in the States. I was born in Augusta, Georgia. And I came to California when I was 4. Mm. And actually, like I lost all my Arabic by the time I was 5, 6 years old. I was like fluent. Mm-hmm. I have videos of me talking fluent Arabic better than I do now at like 4 years old. But as I got older, I lost it because I wasn't really surrounded by anybody Arab besides my immediate family and so on. So I had to like rediscover Arabic music. So that happened when I was in college. I was 19, 20 years old. It was a summer after I think my sophomore year. And my mom, actually, she had all these VHS tapes sitting around that were collecting dust and had to be digitized because at a certain point, you know, 10, 20, 30 years go by, like those things start to disintegrate.
Yeah.
So she was bugging me for months to do it. And I told her, you know, I don't have time, I'm in school. Summer rolled around. I didn't have an excuse. So I start putting in those VHS tapes. And when you're digitized, now this is becoming a, you know, a technology podcast, but this is what I had to do. When you're digitizing the tapes, you can't just like, it's not like burning a CD. You can't just like put it in, burn it, and it's done in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, or now you download something that's an hour. It takes, you know, now it takes 10 seconds to download something like that, right? It's quick. Mm-hmm. These VHS tapes, you have to watch, sit there and let it run. So if it's a 3-hour tape, it has to run for 3 hours. You can't just like speed it up.
Yeah.
So I was initially really pissed about this because I had like 50 of these things to do. It was going to take me all summer. Man. So instead of just, and I needed my computer too. I couldn't just see my computer's running. I need it. So I flipped it on. So I said, well, what if I just sit here and watch them? Will I get anything out of it? Let me just watch them. Mm. This is my uncle's when they're my age, you know, at that time, mm-hmm. my parents are 20 years. Let me just watch them and see. And I was so surprised how much music was in these tapes. Like every event we had was just Arabic music, this Arabic song, that Arabic song, people dancing, people crying, people just having the music just in the background. That was the first thing. And the second thing was I noticed them just speaking Arabic and there's just kind of rhythm to it that's just obviously different than English. And then it just, the gear started working in my mind. What if this was a piece? Like, what if I use some sample? What if I took some samples from these VHS tapes and put them in a piece? So I wrote this piece called Mai, which means water in Arabic. for mm-hmm. string quartet and electronics, where the electronics were these recordings and the VHS tapes. And that was the first time I titled anything with an Arabic title. And the first time I used any kind of Arabic rhythms or melodies, timbres, any of that in any of my pieces. And I just caught the bug from that moment on. That's what I did. So it's been like about over 10 years since I've been doing that. But the 10 years prior to that, I wasn't doing any of that.
Hmm.
You know, so it was like a switch.
I mean, did you notice a shift then in like in composing? Did you feel like more intentional about it? Or when you're like, now you had a concept that was so different from before, did it just change your approach completely?
It felt like I had a project or like I had a purpose. Mm. Because when you're a composer and you're writing piece after piece after piece, it can get really, and I'm sure this is like this with other art, creative fields or even non-creative fields, you know, even just working a 9-to-5 kind of job where you have an employer and so on. If you don't have like a larger, grander purpose, at least if it's just something small, like for yourself, I feel like you start to feel burnout or feel like, why am I doing this? Like, I'm sure people have felt this way. And I was definitely feeling that way at that time when I was at USC, because I was, and this is nothing against this genre of music, but this is just how I felt when I was scoring short films at USC. I was doing one film after another, different styles, different genres. I mean, I learned a ton and I worked with this, a lot of amazing directors, but I felt like I was losing myself while mm-hmm. doing all those projects. I didn't really know who I was. I was just kind of copying styles and I didn't feel like I landed on anything that was my own.
Mm-hmm.
So I was having a lot of fun, don't get me wrong. And I was working with musicians. I would meet with the director that week. I would write out the whole score. And the next weekend we would have it played by the musicians with microphones everywhere. And we'd have the movie up there on the screen. It was just in the moment, amazing. But I thought about what is this like 10, 20, 30 years down the line? Am I going to keep just doing one almost random soundtrack after another, like till the end of time, or at least, you know, till I, you know, retire, whatever. To me, it didn't sound like something that I felt passionate enough about. And I would have continued on that path, but until this eureka moment happened, that was when I like shifted my perception that I can, this is actually my purpose, and that I have the background to be able to put these two things together that I think is different than most people, at least at that time.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good time to have a music break so we can hear another piece by you. This is a performance of Arwa, or Souls in Arabic, performed by the International Contemporary Ensemble, also known as ICE.
Thank you.
Saad, Arawa was written right after the pandemic, correct? Or is it still considered during the pandemic?
I mean, depending on what you define as the end, I guess.
No,
it was definitely like deep into it, like 2 years deep into it. So I think everybody that wanted the vaccine got the vaccine by that time, and people were traveling and so on. So to me, it was like the post, in my mind, it was the post kind of lockdown piece and processing it. How am I processing it individually? That was that piece, Ottawa.
Yeah. Did you find like you needed that out of composing at that time to process what had happened through music?
I mean, I'm not really into these. In my field, I mean, we have a tradition of these kind of pieces, Thread and E for the Victims of Hiroshima. We have pieces like Black Angels by George Crumb, which is like his Vietnam War response piece. We have pieces like John Adams on the Transmigrations of Souls. That was a response to 9/11. So, I mean, there are pieces like that, but I never felt that I ever had to write a piece like that just because I didn't think it was honest if I wasn't going through it personally. And even during COVID itself, I refused to do anything that was COVID centric because I thought, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't have it that bad. I don't know anyone personally in my family that's died or anything like that, or I haven't gotten sick myself, actually. So I can't really say much. But then there was something that clicked. I don't remember what it was specifically, where I just started thinking about it a lot and it just kind of took over my brain. Then I felt it was something I had to do. Not something that I was asked to do or anything like that. It just felt like something I had to do at that time. I can't really explain it. So that's how that piece emerged, much after, I would say, the initial events.
Yeah. So the piece was, you know, it wasn't recorded by like 5 to 10 people in different booths.
No.
You know, no, everybody was coming together again, and it was a real return to...
All the musicians that were not wind instrumentalists were wearing masks, but I mean, everybody was together. We had a concert. There were people in the audience. It was packed, actually, that concert.
That's great.
I kind of came in late, so I almost didn't have a spot to sit, actually. So that was kind of surprising. I think people were just very fed up with watching these live stream concerts. So everyone was excited to go to the show in person. But that was the idea for the piece. And actually that piece led to a lot of other things afterwards, the things that I found in that piece, while I was composing it.
So tell us a little bit more about that. What kind of, okay. So you composed this piece, you know, coming out of the pandemic, how did that lead you on to the next thing?
Well, so, I mean, this relates to the Arabic music influences as well. I was realizing the further that I got in to incorporating this music, that the more I felt that you almost had to be a specialist to get what I was doing. And I didn't like that feeling out of it. So the more recent pieces I've written, including Ottawa, have more of these kind of humanistic themes that feel like all humans. So whether you're Arab, whether you're American, whether you're European, et cetera, you experience. So I've been leaning towards that idea. And then bring in the various Western and Arabic influences into the work. So kind of like reverse engineering, instead of starting from a specific Arabic technique that only a few people know about, I went the opposite way. I said, well, what's like the overall emotion that we as humans have together? What's that emotion exactly? And then how do I use the music to explain that? So this is a relatively recent thing, maybe the last 3 or 4 years that I've been really figuring out. So Ottawa is one of those first pieces, actually, because the piece literally means souls. And the idea of the piece stems from the use of the breath. So instead of having like this Arabic, very deep Arabic idea be the impetus of the piece, it's simply the idea of the human breath. So you hear them literally breathing in their masks. You hear this big gong instrument in the back that's being played with this steel wool sponge. It's the same sponge you use to like clean really dirty, you know, dishes. Uh-huh. When you play it like this on that big gong, it makes a like a white noise kind of sound that sounds like a breath. We did all these kind of crazy techniques on the strings to make it, to make the bow sound like an air sound. So I was really happy with how these things sounded like within that piece. And then I started to use them in other big orchestra pieces after that too.
Do you find it often to get the sound? I mean, that's interesting. Were you like in the kitchen sink and like hearing the scratch, or did someone bring that concept to you to use like the wool kind of sponge?
We had a workshop with the percussionist, and she demonstrated. I told her actually what I wanted. I said, I want it to sound like this. I want it to sound like this. I gave her some breathing sounds, and she said, oh, well, you can do it like this. So she took out the tam-tam and started doing this thing. And I said, oh, okay. Well, what if I put it on the outer edge of the tam-tam on the gong? Mm-hmm. What is that? What if I put it in the center? What if you did it really fast? What if you did it really slow? What if you did it really hard? What if you did it really lightly? And that kind of back and forth was going on. And then I had to figure out how to put these things on paper too, to communicate that to her once she actually plays the piece. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of work back and forth, even for something relatively simple. Like when you hear it, it just sounds like, I mean, it's not anything spectacular when you hear it alone, but combined with everything else, it really, I think, helps the piece a lot.
Yeah. Interesting. So you talked a little bit about, you know, how when you're working with an ensemble like ICE, you can like be with the performers and experiment with them. We know that's not so often the case with orchestral work. So when you're being like commissioned by, like, for instance, like LA Phil, is that like a different kind of energy you're bringing to the rehearsals? Cause you just have to know that it's going to work because you don't have time to sit there and go through the different sounds.
So I'm pretty neurotic when it comes to orchestra, just because I know there, first of all, as a composer, I'm sure this is maybe similar with choreographers, or well, definitely with film directors for sure, because they have so many moving pieces around them. They can't possibly control everything around them, right, on the set. They have to put their trust in people, the cinematographer, the actors themselves, right? And I feel my job as a composer is similar to that, where I have to put my trust in the musicians and the conductor and the organization to give me the proper amount of time, right? So I'm definitely thinking about all those things. But with the piece that I wrote for the LA Phil, which was back in October 2023, my idea was, okay, don't experiment too much with the piece, because I cannot control what the musicians and the conductor do with my experiment. It's not like that I can sit there back and forth like I did with the ICE player over 30 minutes on Zoom. I don't have that kind of time. In reality, with the LA Phil, between all the rehearsals leading up to the first show, I had 66 minutes of rehearsal, and I had a stopwatch and I counted all the minutes while I was sitting there in the back, because I want to know how long does it take, because if XYZ Orchestra wants to play it next season, which I'm very happy there is another orchestra that's going to play that piece. I know, hey, this is not that bad. It's not going to take 3 hours to rehearse. It only will take 66 minutes on the dot. And if it's shorter than that, I'll give you some money back or something. I don't know.
Oh, don't say that. I wouldn't say that.
No, don't say that. I'll cut that part out.
Yeah.
But you know, anyway, don't cut it out. I'm just joking, but it's funny. But yeah, the idea is what have I done in the past music that I know works, that would sound really amazing in a big concert hall setting with 3,000 people sitting there. What are the best things that I did in the last few pieces that I can incorporate in this piece? So that was the piece. It's called Aishin, which means living in Arabic. So kind of a similar theme to the Souls idea. It's kind of, to me, these are like the companion pieces in a way. And I had all the breathing stuff that I mentioned. I put it in the orchestra. But in addition to that, I had, because it's about living, I put this heartbeat kind of motive throughout the orchestra. So there was that additional kind of motive in there to reflect that particular piece. So it was really exciting, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, going back to time with orchestras, and full disclosure, you know, as you know, my day job is executive director of California Symphony, where you are in residence there. And we talked about this, I think, in earlier this year, just about the difference that you get with that residency to have the time to workshop with an orchestra well before the score is even finished. And you hadn't had that experience yet when you went to LA Phil. So do you think, you know, now that you have been in the California Symphony residency and gotten that time, is that going to change either A, though, now that you know you get 66 minutes at LA Phil, are you like using your time differently at California Symphony? Cause you get that 30 minute on top of when you come back months later with the rehearsals. Or is this just like a once in a lifetime? Like, I'll just only get it now this way.
Well, with California Symphony, so back in, so it looks like in January, I had the 30 minute rehearsal where it was great because it was no pressure, because that rehearsal, there was no performance or anything like that. And then I come back 4 months later and I do the real piece that's performed. Mm-hmm. I used that opportunity to do something I knew, well, not I knew didn't work, but I knew could possibly not work. And at the end of the day, actually, it worked what I ended up doing in the moment. But in the grand scheme of things, in terms of like what I was mentioning before, how does it fit with the administration? How does it fit with the program? How does it fit with like the overall concert experience? It didn't fit. Mm. So I learned something from that, that just because something might work with the musicians themselves, it still has to be able to work with the other people involved. So that's why I like to think of like a composer, like a film director or a film producer or something like this, someone that, you know, you maybe something works really well in that one scene, right? But when you put it with the rest of the movie, it doesn't work. You got to cut it out. So that's what ended up happening with my rehearsal in January. But at the same time, when you close one door, another door opens. So after that, I had a meeting with the conductor and the first violinist, and we both agreed on a different route. But if we didn't do that rehearsal, we wouldn't have came up with that second door.
Yeah.
Right? That second door would have been closed. So to me, I was grateful for the opportunity. It might not have elicited the expected result of maybe what the rehearsal was intended for. But at the end of the day, I did move the, what do you call it? I moved the dial or whatever the expression is that I'm forgetting. Yeah.
Move the needle.
Yeah. Move the needle. There you go. I don't know why I said dial.
That works too. I think it works. It's something that moves. And I think speaking from what I think I know, that's what that whole piece, that workshop rehearsal experiment is supposed to be, is an experiment. And maybe that'll show up in a future piece, because now you had that chance to try that. You know, it works.
Yeah,
it might work somewhere else.
It might work better if in another setting where all those pieces that I mentioned earlier are in sync. And actually, it's funny because I just signed a commission recently for another piece where they do want me to, like, that's part of the commission. Like, they want me to work that
Great.
Specifically with these kind of systems where I'm changing how the instruments are tuned. So that's basically what we did with the orchestra. We tuned the instruments to a way that they're not supposed to be in a modern orchestra setting. So that's where the problem arised.
You mentioned, you know, looking at the whole concert experience when it came to this commission. Is that only in the orchestral setting that you look at the whole concert experience? Or is if you're given a commission for anything, are you asking what else is happening around this piece?
Oh yeah. I have to know everything in terms of, well, I like I was mentioning before, kind of neurotic. So this whole idea that I want to know everybody involved, who's the conductor, like, what do they like when they conduct a piece? Like, what are they excited about? What repertoire have they done in the past? You know, if I do something like this, is it in their wheelhouse? Is it not in their wheelhouse? I talk to the conductor. I say, hey, what do you want? Is there anything you want specifically? I look at the rest of the program. Who am I before? Who am I after? Is what I'm going to do going to compliment that performer or that piece, or is it going to go against it? You know? So mm-hmm. I'll give you an example, like with the LA Phil piece, Aisheen. The first thing that I did when I got the commission was I said, who's the conductor? Because I found out it wasn't going to be Gustavo Dudamel. It was another conductor, Alpesh Chahan, who was the guest conductor for that day. So I had a Zoom call for an hour with him. I said, what do you want out of this piece? You know, we don't know each other beforehand, but what do you want? And he told me what I'd really like is some space before we hear Hilary Hahn's Sibelius Concerto. So I would like to have a piece that sets us up to hear her concerto. I said, that's fair. You know, everyone there is there to hear Hilary, not Haddad, you know? So totally understandable. So that's what we agreed to. And that's what we ended up with.
Wow, that's great. It's interesting just to see how that all kind of comes together and the thoughtfulness that you're bringing to your commissions. Is that unique to you? I imagine you're not
nothing
sitting around talking.
Nothing is unique to me. Nothing is unique to me, first of all. That's the other way. I steal a lot of ideas from people that I admire, you know, and not just in the music world, in the business world too. And so on. Like I think that sometimes we're a little bit insular with where we take our influences and how you can have a career and or whatever we call this life in music. But no, there are people that, of course, there are people that want to know what the rest of the program is, want to know what does the conductor want or think, what the musicians do, of course, you know. But there are also composers that are the other way. They don't necessarily communicate what they're going to do, or sometimes turn in pieces a little bit later. But that also elicits some level of creativity. I know I'm not going to say any names, but I know composers that are like that. And God, I admire them so much. Like I look at their music and I'm like, I can't do what they're doing. But you know, some of the ways that they go about their day to day is not how I would do it. Right. But like the music that they come out, like, you can't argue with it though, because that's the music that they have. And it's so amazing. How can I say that they're doing it wrong when the result is so tremendous? So I don't think there's any one way to do this. This is just my way. It's just the way that works for me. That's it.
So we talked a lot about, you know, your compositions, obviously you're a composer, but I know besides commissions and composing, you have a really popular YouTube channel, which has like quite a following and quite like a lot of long form episodes. When did you start that? And like, what made you decide to start talking about your career online?
Well, first of all, I get in my day to day, I'm already asked a lot of questions by my colleagues. It's just funny. Cause I like, we're all in school and stuff like that. But I always am getting asked by my colleagues, questions about how I do this, how I do that, what should I do here? And I was just realized that one day, I'm like, well, you know, I keep answering the same questions over and over again in real life. Like, is anybody else interested in any of this stuff too? And my other thought process was while I was teaching at Columbia from about 2008, 2019 to the present, I teach an undergraduate course called Music Humanities. I realized that I had a love of teaching, which I didn't have before. Quite the opposite. I always thought, well, if I end up being a teacher, I'm a failure as a composer, yada, yada, yada. I always had that thought. And once I started teaching and being in the classroom and like presenting and discussing with the students, I said, well, actually, this is it. This is actually the exciting part of this whole thing, like sharing with other people. So those two things intersected, the me helping other composers in my real life and like, you know, and talking shop, right? Mm-hmm. And me teaching these undergraduates at Columbia that by the way, have zero music background. So we're not talking notation or anything theoretical. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all like socioeconomic stuff, cultural stuff, things like that. So those two intersected at just the right time in 2020, 2021. And then I started shooting a couple of videos just to see what happens. And I just got the bug. I just loved doing it. I was like, this is it. this combined both things somehow. And I haven't missed an upload in like almost 2 years at this point.
Well, you do it every week?
Yeah, every single week I have one video. So I've had, I think on my channel, I also have some short videos. So it's a lot more than 100 videos. I think it's over 400 videos now. Many of them are about 100 or so of them are longer videos, and the rest are shorter videos, like clips of my pieces and so on. So I've kept up with that. And, you know, the more you do something, you get better at it, of course. And also there's not really many people online that are talking about these topics at the level of depth I am, as well as people that are actually doing it, you know. So while I'm doing this, I'm like writing music. I'm not just teaching, you know, I'm also composing, doing this. So it's a lot, but there's not one thing that I like doing more than the other. I feel like the crazy thing is like all of them have to like kind of keep going. So that one informs the other. My teaching informs the YouTube thing. The composing informs the YouTube thing, because I get content from the composing. I get content from the teaching too. So if I'm not composing, I'm not teaching, I don't have anything to share on YouTube. And I'm just a YouTuber. You know, I'm just like somebody just talking.
Unboxing your...
Yeah, like what is... like? I mean, nothing against them, but like, you know, to me, it's the purpose of YouTube and sharing and that's and those sites is to share what you do in your real life, not for that to become your real life. So... anyway, I've been blabbing a little too much, but that's
No, it's good. It's
I mean, thought a lot about this, as you can hear.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, just your music, your YouTube channel. The season is coming to a close. Do you have anything you want to talk about that's on the horizon?
Well, on the horizon, I have some things that are going on. Of course, I'm writing another piece for the California Symphony for next season. So that's underway. I'm also writing a piece for a group in Switzerland called Ensemble Proton Burn. And that piece will be exciting because it's a big 30-minute extravaganza piece with a microtonal organ. Basically, this thing has, if you can imagine a piano that has 12 notes per octave, the white and the black keys, imagine this thing having three extra notes in between each of the keys. So I'm really excited about that, because that's right in my wheelhouse in terms of exploration of pitch. Besides that, those are the only things I can talk about, but I'm excited to just keep doing projects. Like I'm really excited that people, when they ask me to do a project, they know that I would be happy to take it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
In terms of like, they know, okay, like this will be something he's interested in, but we're going to push the envelope a little bit further in terms of this thing that I want him to try exploring. And that's what the Proton Burn folks are doing in Switzerland, at least with this piece I'm writing them.
Very cool. Well, that's all the time we have. For more information about Saad Haddad, you can visit saadnhaddad.com. Saad, thank you so much for being my guest today and for sharing your insights and experiences with us. We're going to end our program with your piano concerto. I don't know if you want to leave us with a few words about that before we close.
Oh, yeah. This piano concerto, Meshahid, which just means scenes in Arabic. This is a piece I wrote for an orchestra in Paris. Just five little scenes. You're probably just going to play... are you playing the whole thing or
I'm gonna find out how long is it?
Okay, it's like 10 minutes, but
we'll
so there are five little scenes, each one's 2 minutes long, and they each basically that my idea for the piece is that they're describing how a composer from the past might have written had they heard Arabic music. So for example, like I have a movement about Debussy, I have a movement about Bach, etc. I don't make these obvious in the piece itself, but that was what I was thinking when I was writing the piece.
Great. Well, thank you. That's a good way to send us off. So thank you, Saad.
Thanks, Lisa. Thank you.
Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Lisa Dell. Thanks so much for listening.